I am a poor pilgrim of sorrow. I'm lost in this wide world alone. No hope have I for tomorrow. I've started to make heaven my home.
You are listening to the voice of Maya Angelou singing a spiritual her grandmother used to sing in the church choir back in Stamps, Arkansas. Ms. Angelou has published 2 volumes of autobiography entitled I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings and Gathered Together in My Name, as well as 2 volumes of poetry, Just Give Me a Cool Drink of Water Before I Die and Oh Pray My Wings Are Gonna Fit Me Well. We now present Maya Angelou reading and singing from each of her works and speaking with Lynn Harris about her art and her life.
Sometimes I don't know where to roam, but I heard of a city called heaven. And I've started to make it my home.
Mama had married 3 times. Mama, for me, was my grandmother. She had married Mr. Johnson, my grandfather, who left her around the turn of the century with 2 small sons to raise. Second, Mr. Henderson, of whom I know nothing at all. Mama never answered questions directly put to her on any subject except religion. Then finally, Mr. Murphy. I saw him a fleeting once. He came through Stamps on a Saturday night, and Grandmother gave me the chore of making his pallet on the floor. He was a stocky, dark man who wore a snap-brim hat like George Raft. The next morning, he hung around the store until we returned from church. That marked the first Sunday I knew Uncle Willie to miss services. Bailey said he stayed home to keep Mr. Murphy from stealing us blind. Mr. Murphy left in the middle of the afternoon after one of Mama's extensive Sunday dinners. His hat pushed back off his forehead. He walked down the road whistling. I watched his thick back until he turned the bend by the big white church. People spoke of Mama as a good-looking woman, and some, who remembered her youth, said she used to be right pretty. I saw only her power and strength. She was taller than any woman in my personal world, and her hands were so large they could span my head from ear to ear. Her voice was soft only because she chose to keep it so. In church, when she was called upon to sing, she seemed to pull out plugs from behind her jaws, and the huge, almost rough sound would pour over the listeners and throb in the air. Each Sunday, after she had taken her seat, the minister would announce, "We will now be led in a hymn by Sister Henderson." And each Sunday, she looked up with amazement at the preacher and asked silently, "Me?" After a second of assuring herself that she was indeed being called upon, she laid down her handbag and slowly folded her handkerchief. This was placed neatly on top of the purse. Then she leaned on the bench in front of her and pushed herself to a standing position. And then she opened her mouth, and the song jumped out as if it had only been waiting for the right time to make an appearance.
I am a poor pilgrim of sorrow. I'm lost in this wide world alone. No hope have I for tomorrow. I've started to make heaven my home. My mother, she's found her sweet glory. my father still living in sin. And my brothers and sisters won't own me because I am trying to get in. Sometime I'm tossed and I'm driven, Lord. Sometimes I don't know where to roam. But I heard of a city called heaven, and I've started to make it my home.
Week after week, and year after year, the performance never changed, and yet I don't remember anyone's ever remarking on her sincerity or her readiness to sing. Mama intended to teach Bailey, my brother, and me to use the paths in life that she and her generation and all the Negroes gone before had found, and found to be safe ones. She didn't cotton to the idea that white folks could be talked to at all without risking one's life, and certainly they couldn't be spoken to insolently. In fact, even in their absence, they could not be spoken of too harshly unless we use the sobriquet they. If she had been asked and had chosen to answer the question of whether she was cowardly or not, she would have said that she was a realist. Didn't she stand up to them year after year? Wasn't she the only Negro woman in stamps referred to once as Mrs.? That incident became one of stamps' little legends. Some years before Bailey and I arrived in the town, a man was hunted down for assaulting white womanhood. In trying to escape, he ran to the store. Mama and Uncle Willie hid him behind the shiver robe until night, gave him supplies for an overland journey, and sent him on his way. He was, however, apprehended, and in court, when he was asked his movements of the day of the crime, he replied that after he had heard that he was being sought, he had taken refuge in Mrs. Henderson's store. The judge asked that Mrs. Henderson be subpoenaed, and when Mama arrived and said that she was Mrs. Henderson, the judge, the bailiff, and all the other whites in the audience laughed. The judge had really made a gaffe, calling a Negro woman Mrs. But then he was from Pine Bluff, and couldn't have been expected to know that a woman who owned a store in that village would also turn out to be colored. The whites tickled their funny bones with the incident for a long time, and the Negroes thought it proved the worth and the majesty of my grandmother. The last inch of space was filled, yet people continued to wedge themselves along the walls of the store. Uncle Willie had turned the radio up to its last notch so that youngsters on the porch wouldn't miss a word. Women sat on kitchen chairs, dining room chairs, stools, and upturned wooden boxes. Small children and babies perched on every lap available, and men leaned on the shelves or on each other. The apprehensive mood was shot through with shafts of gaiety as a black sky is streaked with lightning. One man said, "I ain't worried about this fight. Joe gonna whip that cracker like it's open season." Another said, "He gonna whip him till that white boy called him mama." At last the talking was finished and the string-along songs about razor blades were over and the fight began. "A quick jab to the head." In the store the crowd grunted. "A left to the head and a right and another left." One of the listeners cackled like a hen and was quieted. "They're in a clinch. Lewis is trying to fight his way out." Some bitter comedian on the porch said, "That white man don't mind hugging that nigger now, I betcha." "The referee is moving in to break them up, but Lewis finally pushes the contender away, and it's an uppercut to the chin. The contender is hanging on. Now he's backing away. Lewis catches him with a short left to the jaw." A tide of murmuring assent poured out the doors and into the yard. "Another left and another left. Lewis is saving that mighty right." The mutter in the store had grown into a baby roar, and it was pierced by the clang of a bell and the announcer's, "That's the bell for round three, ladies and gentlemen." As I pushed my way into the store, I wondered if the announcer gave any thought to the fact that he was addressing as ladies and gentlemen, all the Negroes around the world who sat sweating and praying, glued to their master's voice. There were only a few calls for RC Colas, Dr. Peppers, and Heyer's Root Beer. The real festivities would begin after the fight. Then even the old Christian ladies who taught their children and tried themselves the practice of turning the other cheek would buy soft drinks. And if the Brown Bombers' victory was a particularly bloody one, they would order peanut patties and Baby Ruth's also. Bailey and I laid the coins on top the cash register. Uncle Willie didn't allow us to ring up sales during a fight. It was too noisy and might shake up the atmosphere. When the gong rang for the next round, we pushed through the near-sacred quiet to the herd of children outside. "He's got Lewis on the ropes, and now it's a left to the body and a right to the ribs, another right to the body. It looks like it was low. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the referee is signaling, but the contender keeps raining the blows on Lewis. It's another to the body, and it looks like Lewis is going down." My race groaned. It was our people falling. It was another lynching, yet another black man hanging on a tree. One more woman ambushed and raped, a black boy whipped and maimed. It was hounds on the trail of a man running through slimy swamps. It was a white woman slapping her maid for being forgetful. The men in the store stood away from the walls and at attention. Women greedily clutched the babies on their laps, while on the porch the shufflings and smiles, the flirtings and pinchings of a few minutes before were gone. This might be the end of the world. If Joe lost, we were back in slavery and beyond help. It would all be true, the accusations that we were lower types of human beings, only a little higher than the apes. True that we were stupid and lazy and ugly and dirty and unlucky, and worst of all that God himself hated us and ordained us to be hewers of wood and drawers of water forever and ever, world without end. We didn't breathe, we didn't hope, we waited. "He's off the ropes, ladies and gentlemen, he's moving toward the center of the ring." This was no time to be relieved, the worst might still happen. "And now it looks like Joe is mad. He's caught Canero with a left hook to the head and a right to the head. It's a left jab to the body, another left to the head. There's a left cross and a right to the head. The contender's right eye is bleeding. He can't seem to keep his block up. Lewis is penetrating every block. The referee is moving in, but Lewis sends a left to the body, and it's an uppercut to the chin, and the contender is dropping. He's on the canvas, ladies and gentlemen." Baby slid to the floor as women stood up and men leaned toward the radio. "Here's the referee. He's counting. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Is the contender trying to get up again?" All the men in the store shouted, "No! 8, 9, 10. There were a few sounds from the audience, but they seemed to be holding themselves in against tremendous pressure. "The fight is all over, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get the microphone over to the referee. Here he is. He's got the Brown Bummer's hand. He's holding it up. Here he is." Then that voice, husky and familiar, came to wash over us. "The winner and still heavyweight champion of the world, Joe Lewis." Champion of the world. A black boy. Some black mother's son. He was the strongest man in the world. People drank Coca-Colas like ambrosia and ate candy bars like Christmas. Some of the men went behind the store and poured white lightning in their soft drink bottles, and a few of the bigger boys followed them. Those who were not chased away came back blowing their breath in front of themselves like proud smokers. It would take an hour or more before the people would leave the store and head for home. Those who lived too far had made arrangements to stay in town. You see, it wouldn't do for a black man and his family to be caught on a lonely country road on a night when Joe Lewis had just proved that we were the strongest people in the world. Most people who write autobiographies are talking about facts.
Mm-hmm.
And they're informative. I'm trying to talk about the truth. What brought this about? What was the underlying, mm-hmm. you know, motive in this circumstance? Okay, it's true that you and I are sitting here, but there are those are facts. But your tiredness is a truth. Mine is a truth. The energy we're pulling up to get through this and still enjoy and be cheerful, those are the truths. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm about, and I hope to become great in it. By the fourth, fifth book, I should really have the form down.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult for me to talk about the work because it's difficult to write it in the first place. In the first place, I have to almost enchant myself back to that time so that all the smells, all the background sounds, everything, all the textures are there. I'm there again. So I don't write it from a position of security and talk about it, and as told to, that sort of sense. And so I have to be there. And it's painful. I had often noticed Troubadour Martin at Keynes. He was extremely tall and dangerously thin. When I used to see him, he reminded me of the phrase often used to describe me, a long drink of water. He came to my house a week after my job ran out. That was how I had begun to think of it. His movements were slow and his speech a long time coming. We sat in my living room. He said, "Hello, Rita." I said, "Hi, Troub." There was a pause. "Heard you not working for Kane no more." I said, "No, the job ran out." There was a wait. "Well, you find anything yet?" I said, "No, I'm taking a rest." Hesitation. "Of course." Delay. He said, "Maybe you can help me." I demurred. This time I didn't intend to jump at the first persuasion. He was black and handsome, and when the light fell right across his face, he looked like a thin Paul Robeson. I also knew he wasn't one of the men who sent out for drinks. He said, "Maybe you know I deal in clothes." Well, I knew he was a gambler. I said, "No." He said, "I have a connection for ladies' dresses and suits. New." He shook his head before my question. He said, "They're not hot. I run sort of like a catalog business. I'll tell you what I need. See, you won't have to do nothing. I'll bring the things, and ladies can come over here to try them on." He smiled slowly and dropped his eyes. I saw the southern shyness of the man and knew the clothes were stolen. He said, "You know how you ladies are. Wouldn't like to undress unless there's another lady around." I didn't know about that, but I said nothing. He said, "And you don't have to sell. I'll do that. I'll give you a percentage of the money. How's that?" There was nothing to think about. I agreed. I'd have money coming in, and my time would be my own. I could read all day and take my child to the park and to movies. I would have the time to teach him to read, and I'd be beholden to no one. Troubadour wasn't interested in me romantically, so I didn't have to concern myself about getting involved with him. I said, "All right, Troub, when do we start?" He said, "I'll bring some things around tonight." His words lingered. "I'm glad to be working with you. Every time I used to see you, I thought to myself, that's a real nice lady. Sure did." He left me with a demure smile. After 2 months, my closets were filled with expensive 2- and 3-piece suits. Dresses, sweaters, and stockings crammed my drawers, and I spent my days reading Thomas Wolfe and going to the movies with my child. I had cut down my visits to San Francisco. My mother's house was dim with foreboding tragedy, and Bailey still hadn't got his, quote, bankroll together, unquote. He was thinner, and the new clothes didn't fit. The shirt sleeve slid down to cover half his hands, and his stomach couldn't resist his belt's descent. His color seemed to have faded, and his once fast speech had slowed nearly to Troub's rhythm. For her part, Mother talked faster and popped her fingers louder, but her laughter shattered out of her mouth unreal. There was no happiness in that house. In Oakland, my fancy settled upon becoming Mrs. Troubadour Martin. He was kind, generous, and quiet, and though we had made a desultory kind of love a few times, he'd never ask for more. He was the ideal husband. Troubadour was definitely strung out on heavy narcotics. Even when I smoked grass, he would take only 1 or 2 drags and let me have the rest. I had waited to see when he would try to introduce me to heroin, and hadn't been quite sure how I'd respond. Order him out of my house, or consider that he'd made enough money to be able to keep us both high for life. One hit of heroin wouldn't make me an addict, I thought. And maybe if I shot it once, he'd know I didn't disapprove and our relationship would be closer. Since he never answered my direct questions about heroin, I schemed to bring about a confrontation. I said, "Troubadour, I think you'll have to find someone else." He asked, "Why, Rita?" Even shock didn't scurry across his face. I said, "I think you've been keeping something from me, or you have an old lady, and I think I'm beginning to fall for you." It wasn't difficult to make myself cry. All I had to do was think about losing my soft perch, or my brother, or my mother, or the long-lost Curly. He said, "Rita, I've told you I don't have any woman." My tears flowed. I said, "But you never take me with you. I'm not a girl. I want to be your woman and share everything with you. You don't care about me." He said, "Yes, I do, Rita. I like you. You're just fine." I said, "But you don't want me. Is that it?" He said, "No, that's not it." At last, he was speaking a little faster. I said, "Then if you want me, stop hiding from me what you do. I can take it." I dried my tears enough to look at him. His eyes squinched together and his jaws clenched. He looked straight at me. "Can you leave the baby for a while? Come for a ride with me." Here it was. I had to leave the baby alone. Nothing ventured. True pointed the car toward San Francisco. I asked, "Where are we going?" I'd expected he was taking me to his room, which was in Oakland near my house. He didn't answer. The Bay Bridge amber lights washed out his brown earth color, and he was a cold, sallow stranger. I couldn't show panic. I said, "Oh, to the city, huh? That's nice. Did I ever tell you I have only a little while to live? I have a brain tumor, and the doctors gave me 6 months." I had planned that speech years before to be used if I encountered a rapist or a murderer. And then I'd add, "They can't operate. It's too near the cerebellum." Troubadour stared at the streets and chose one. I was dismayed to see we were on the waterfront. My God, he was a freak of some kind, and this was going to be the last few minutes of my life. I still couldn't scream. He stopped the car on the wharf. "Come on, Rita." I asked, "But where are we going?" He said, "I want to show you something." There was an absoluteness about the way he spoke and nodded his head toward the opposite side of the street. A pale sign said hotel. I was glad I hadn't screamed. A hotel? Well, maybe his house was hot and he was bringing me to the hotel to show me the ropes. I followed him through the fog across four sets of railroad tracks to the hotel. He walked straight to the desk and told a chalky white clerk, "Give me the key." The clerk didn't hesitate, and I still followed a little shaken. Did he keep a room here to act out some extravagant fantasy? He turned the key in a lock, and I went sheep-like into the room. My first impression was that I was in a city bus station very early in the morning. People sat and lounged on every available space. Three bodies were draped over a bed. Men and women sat on the floor, backed by the wall. Two women sat in one chair, and all, black and white, were dozing off or waking up or fast asleep. No one noticed our entrance. Troubadour reached back for me in the dim lamplight. "Come on," he said. I reeled and tried to shake my sluggish brain awake, but it couldn't compute the situation. It seemed a slow whole minute before the scene registered. This was a hit joint for addicts. Fear flushed my face and neck and made the room tremble before me. I'd been prepared to experiment with drugs, but I hadn't counted on this ugly exposure. As I watched the wretched nod and scratch, I felt my own innocence, as real as a grain of sand between my teeth. I was as pure as moonlight, and had only begun to live. My escapades were the fumblings of youth, and to be forgiven as such. I twisted for the door behind me and tried to snatch my hand away, but Troubadour held on. "Come on," he said. "I want you to see something." I was afraid to scream and alarm the addicts in their dreaming. If I pulled free and reached the lobby, would the desk clerk know I wasn't going to the police and allow me to go? Troubadour tugged at me, and we stumbled over outstretched legs toward an open bathroom door. In the bathroom, he removed his jacket and gave it to me. He rolled up his shirt sleeve. Time for Troubadour and me moved as if we were swimming under water. He took a tablespoon from the sink and a small square of paper from his pocket. The senses of sound, taste, and touch had disappeared, but I had never seen so clearly or smelled so acutely. The powder was dusted into the spoon, and he dribbled a little water over it. He held 3 matches under the belly of the spoon while the mixture simmered. The sweet smell went into my nose and unlocked my tongue. I said, "Don't do it, Troubadour. Please don't." He said, "Shut up and watch me." He tied his arm above the elbow with his tie and tightened it with his teeth. Then he took a syringe from the grimy face bowl and filled it with a hot, clear liquid. High-standing keloid scars ran down his inner arm, and the black flesh was purple and yellow in a place with fresh sores. He pushed the needle into a scar and wiggled it around, then took it out and tried another. I said, "Please, Troubadour." He said, "Shut up and watch this." The needle pricked one of the soft scabs, and rich yellow pus flowed out and down his arm to the wrist. My tears, which had been terror-frozen, thawed at the sight of the man who had been so nice to me, jabbing and picking in his own flesh, oblivious to the pain and the ugliness. The needle found its place, and blood, mixed with a few drops of heroin, had snaked across his upheld arm. He loosened the tie with his teeth, and, as if I had X-ray vision, I watched the narcotic reach his brain. His face muscles slackened, and he leaned heavily against the wall. He asked, "Now, you want some?" Slow lips, slow question. I said, "No." He said, "You sure? I can cook it up for you." His head lolled, but he kept his eyes on me. I said, "I'm sure I don't want it." He said, "Then I want you to promise me you won't use it. It's nothing. You're a lady reader. I don't want to see you change. Promise me you'll stay like I found you. Nice." I said, "I promise." He said, "Let me rest a little in the car. Then I'll take you home." He slumped behind the steering wheel for a half hour, and I watched him. I thought about the kindness of the man. I had wanted him before for the security I thought he'd give me. I loved him as he slouched, nodding, his mouth open and the saliva sliding down his chin as slowly as the blood had flowed down his arm. No one had ever cared for me so much. He had exposed himself to me to teach me a lesson, and I learned it as I sat in the dark car, inhaling the odors of the wharf. The life of the underworld was truly a rat race, and most of its inhabitants scurried like rodents in the sewers and the gutters of the world. I had walked the precipice and seen it all, and at a critical moment, one man's generosity pushed me safely away from the ledge. He finally awakened, and we headed back to Oakland. In front of my house, I told him he should take his clothes. I explained that I planned to move back to the city. He said, "No, you sell them. You need the money. You've got a baby. There are plenty more stores, and there are plenty more clothes." The next day, I took my clothes, my bags, and my child back to my mother's. I had no idea what I was going to make of my life. But I had given a promise, and I had found my innocence, and I swore I would never lose it again. When I'm asked, you know, how did you make it, you know, if one looks at my life and considers that an anthropologist or sociologist would look at my early life and say, "I'm a born loser. Have to be. Child of a broken family, raped at 7 1/2, growing up in poverty, black in the South without parents, direct parents, an unmarried mother at 16. It would seem that, you know, there's no way out. But I've had so many people be kind to me, and I've always recognized kindness. you know, mm-hmm. no matter how it might be shielded, you know, or tendered. And when I think of Troubadour, which is not his real name, but when I think of that man, I've dedicated the book in part to him, because he was so kind. When a human being allows another human being to see her or him at his most base, that's a gesture of such generosity that it's hard to even write about it. But it does in turn, hopefully, make me generous, so that I wrote the book to say to young people, you might encounter many defeats, but you must not be defeated. Look ahead, you know? And today, I'm a Chubb Fellow at Yale University. Honorary degrees from Smith and Mills. I speak 7 languages. I'm a distinguished professor at 3 universities. I've just finished directing 2 movies in Hollywood. First black female director. Mm-hmm. Card-carrying member of the Directors Guild. I write plays, and I write the scores for movies and books and poetry, and I have a monthly article in Playgirl magazine. And I'm a presidential appointee on the bicentennial, and on the board of trustees of the American Film Institute. A good wife and a good mother. And I'm about to be a grandmother.
Wow.
That's fantastic. that's the stuff. So how then, except that I've had a lot of help, which immediately makes me responsible for being a lot of help. You see?
Did you write poetry before you began your autobiographies?
Yes, I wrote poetry from about 12 years old on. I've always tried to write it.
Mm-hmm.
I love poetry so, you know. And I heard it in the black music and in the written poetry as well. But I loved the church songs and the blues because the lines are so pretty. There's mm-hmm. a blues that says, "If you don't believe I'm sinking, look what a hole I'm in. And if you don't believe I love you, look what a fool I've been."
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty stuff. And a line in again, old blues, it says, "He's blacker than midnight, teeth like flags of truce. He's the sweetest thing in the whole St. Louis." They do say, "The blacker the berry, sweeter is the juice." It's such a pretty thing. And one line in the blues says, "My baby is chocolate to the bone." So I love that. And of course, then there's a line, "Green trees are bending, poor sinner stands are trembling." That's so pretty. The poetry is asked to be magical, mystical, lyrical, and musical. And so I grew up on that poetry, and I knew it. I don't know how I knew it was poetry, but I knew it then. So I started writing it badly, but I still tried, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you've always loved reading.
Yes. I couldn't hardly live without it, even now.
Mm-hmm.
I read constantly. And, of course, a lot for information's sake,
mm-hmm.
just to know how people live and, you know, facts, but also for my spirit, for the sake of my soul.
I remember in I know why the caged bird sings, that you said one of the first men you fell in love with was William Shakespeare.
Yes.
And how did you come to that? First of all, it's so hard to read for anybody, but for a child to approach it and assimilate it and see the beauty in it.
But there were so many things that seemed so clear to me. When I was, after I had been raped, I went through a period where I just couldn't talk. I could talk to my brother, but I couldn't get the words out. And there was a woman in the town, Mrs. Flowers, black lady, who took me to the black school and said she wanted me to read that whole library. So she started me at A, and she said, I want you to read to D by the time I come back to Stamps. And she used to go away for 4 or 5 months. Mm-hmm. And I did. And then after I'd read every book, understanding maybe a 100th mm-hmm. of what I'd read, she brought me books from the white school. I don't know how she had contacts at the white school, but she did. And she used to bring 4 or 5 books. I'd see her coming up the road, you know. And she'd have her arms filled with books. And I knew they were for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, but Shakespeare, I found The Rape of Lucrece, which is an incredible piece of, an incredible work. And in it, he talks about time and opportunity. After Lucrece is raped, she blames time, and she blames opportunity and night. And I could understand that. So I read it and loved it. And then I read the sonnets, and some of them I could understand. I loved When in Disgrace with Fortune. Because it was my position.
Mm-hmm.
It was a position of many blacks. It could have been written by a black poet who would rather have somebody else's color, somebody else's skin and hair and position. He says, when in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone bemoan my outcast state. I trouble a deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate. I'm wishing me like to one more rich in hope, like him with friends possessed. I'm desiring this man's art and that man's scope, and with what I most enjoy, I'm contented least. It certainly could have been a black person's, it was a black person's position and need. So I loved Shakespeare, and I wanted to recite Shakespeare
mm-hmm.
when I did start talking. But of course, I knew I'd have to tell my grandmother that Shakespeare was white, and that would be the end of that. I thought maybe if I told her he was dead and had been dead a long time, she might forgive him, but no, didn't work.
Do you, I noticed in your own poetry, there's a lot of rhyme and strong rhythm, and I was wondering if you preferred writing in form rather than, did you come first to try to emulate poets that had used strict form and strict
yes,
meter?
I did. First, another poet, I loved Paul Laurence Dunbar.
Mm-hmm.
Who has the most intricate kinds of rhymes and rhythms, because he wrote in the black language of the time, and he just was so successful, and I loved his poetry because it all sang. I also loved Edgar Allan Poe for the same reason. The poem sang. I mean, there was rhythms and counter-rhythms and polyrhythms. And when I first started, that was my intent, to write everything. Everything was in rhythm. I mean, in strict tempo, rather. Mm-hmm. And then as I worked at being a poet, I found that every subject I wanted to deal with had its own rhythm. So when a poem seems to be out of form, it is not. It has its rhythm. It might not be rhymed, and the rhythm might not be strict. The tempo might change.
But it follows an internal rhythm.
There is an internal rhythm to the piece.
Mm-hmm.
So when I start to write a poem, I think about the subject. And then I write everything I know about the subject down. So it might take 10 or 15 pages. And then I live with that until I can figure out what is the rhythm of this piece. You know, if it's hopscotch, there's a rhythm to it. If it's women crying, there's a rhythm. If there's loss of love, there is a rhythm, depending on whether you're talking about a day or an old love, a new love. And so then I let the content dictate the rhythm. Then I work to bring it within that form, within that framework.
Yeah. I think we should read some of the poetry now.
Okay.
All right? Since you mentioned hopscotch.
Read hopscotch.
Read hopscotch.
Okay. Hopscotch, wherever it's jumped, has the rhythm, dun-dun-jump. Dun dun chun, dun dun chun, and the turns, dun dun chun. Well, in Harlem, New York, or Harlem, Winston-Salem, that's the rhythm, but then there are other rhythms laid on top. So it becomes dun dun chun ka ta dun gung ka ta dun 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 chun ka ta dun gung ka ta da dun, so forth. And what the children think who jump it in Harlem are other thoughts than those who jumped on Park Avenue. So I wrote Harlem Hopscotch. 1 foot down in hop is hot. Good things for the ones that's got. Another jump now to the left. Everybody for himself. In the air, now both feet down. Since you're black, don't stick around. Food is gone. Rent is due. You cuss and cry, and then you jump too. Everybody's out of work. Hold for three and then twist and jerk. Cross the line, they count you out. But that's what hopping's all about. Both feet flat, the game is done. They think I lost, I know I won.
Beautiful.
The rhythms are wonderful to work with for me, mm-hmm. as a poet. There's the a poem for women, particularly for women, written for the woman who has the affair with a married man or with a man who has other commitments. So often men who are involved with women outside their main relationship don't leave it at that. They also go home and either explicitly or implicitly allow their wives to know that they do have this other involvement. So they drag both women. And this is from the second woman's point of view. They went home and told their wives that never once in all their lives had they met a girl like me. But they went home. They said my house was licking clean. No word I spoke was ever mean. And I had an air of mystery. But they went home. My praises were on all men's lips. They liked my smile, my wit, my hips. They'd spend one night, or two, or three. But. This poem isn't the man's answer to they went home. There's a long-legged girl in San Francisco by the Golden Gate. She said she'd give me all I wanted, but I just couldn't wait. I started to picking them up and laying them down, picking them up and laying them down, picking them up and laying them down, getting to the next town, baby. There's a pretty brown in Birmingham. Boy, she's little and cute. But when she liked to tie me down, I had to grab my suit and start to picking them up and laying them down, picking them up and laying them down, picking them up and laying them down, and getting to the next town, baby. I met that lovely Detroit lady and thought my time had come. But just before I said, I do, I said, I got to run, and started to picking them up and laying them down, picking them up and laying them down, picking them up and laying them down, getting to the next town, baby. There ain't no words for what I feel about a pretty face. But if I stay, I just might miss a prettier one someplace. That's why I start that picking them up, laying them down, picking them up, laying them down, picking them up, laying them down, getting to the next town, baby. Ruthless. And this was written before I met my husband, the man who was to become my husband. I seem to have found bits and pieces for years. It's called Here's to Adhering. I went to a party out in Hollywood. The atmosphere was shoddy, but the drinks were good, and that's where I heard you laugh. I then went cruising on an old Greek ship. The crew was amusing, but the guests weren't hip. That's where I found your hands. On to the Sahara in a caravan. The sun was like an arrow, but the nights were grand, and that's how I found your chest. An evening in the Congo where the Congo ends, I found myself alone, oh, but I made some friends. That's where I saw your face. I have been devoting all my time to get parts of you out floating, still unglued as yet. Won't you pull yourself together for me once? And one more. This, ridiculous. The diversity of prejudices that obtain in what James Baldwin calls it, these yet-to-be United States, are so bizarre. I see none more bizarre than the ageists, you know, the old people who look at young people and say they're not serious. I mean, they're silly and long-haired. The young people who look at old people and say, they're stupid, we should do away with them, and isn't it awful to be 60 or 70, unnecessary. When, if the truth be told, everybody's dream is to become old. Nobody wants to die. This is called On Reaching 40. Other acquainted years sidle with modest decorum across the scrim of toughened tears, and to a stage planked with laughter boards and waxed with rueful loss. But 40, with the authorized brazenness of a uniformed cop, stomps no knocking into the script, bumps a funky grind on the shabby curtain of youth, and delays the action, unless you have the inborn wisdom and grace and are clever enough to die at 39. Some pretty love poems. Okay. This is really a song. So I'll sing it.
Please.
You've got another love, and I know it. Someone who adores you just like me. Hanging on your words like they were gold, thinking that she understands your soul. Poor girl, just like me. You're breaking another heart, and I know it. And there's nothing I can do. If I try to tell her what I know, she'll misunderstand and make me go. Poor girl. Just like me. You can't explain a single thing to folks in a new romance. They'll see the proof and know the truth, and still they'll take a chance. You're gonna leave her too, and I know it. She'll never know what made you go. She'll cry and wonder what went wrong. Then she'll begin to sing this song. Poor girl, just like me.
Do you do much singing?
No, recording? I sing in church. Mm-hmm. And at home. Oh, that's pretty. This is a song I wrote for two young white people. For all, really. For all of us. But particularly, it was inspired by two young white people who were sitting on a street in London. I used to go to London to write, because at that time I didn't like London. Since I've married, my husband is working class. I like the working class in England, but I hadn't met any. So I used to go there for 4 or 5 months. And I was working one morning. Around 7 o'clock, I left my apartment. I walked down the street, and there were two young people sitting on a road, on King's Road, with their backs against the wall. And the man who, I guess, owned the shop or managed it, came outside and looked at them and spat on them. I didn't know what to do. All my pores were open, mind you, because I was working. You know, I was really vulnerable in that. And if they had been black, I'd have had a response, a ready response. I wouldn't have had to think. But as it was, I stood there, I looked at him, I looked at them, and I thought, he can't look at them and say they're not English. He hadn't heard a word, you know, they could have been Swedish. He couldn't say what they were. And I knew that they were his tomorrows, as they are my tomorrows, but more directly his. So I went home, I cursed and screamed and said lots of things, but I went home and wrote a song. And it's in this book. When you see them on the freeway hitching rides, wearing beads with their packs by their sides, you ought to ask, what's all the warring and the jarring and the killing and the thrilling all about? Take time out. When you see him with a band around his head and an army surplus bunk that makes his bed, you'd better ask, what's all the beating and the cheating and the bleeding and the needing all about? Take time out. When you see her walking barefoot in the rain, and you know she's tripping on a one-way train, you need to ask, what's all the lying and the dying and the running and the gunning all about? Take time out. Use a minute, feel some sorrow for the folks who think tomorrow is a place that they can call up on the phone. Take a month and show some kindness for the folks who thought that blindness was an illness that affected eyes alone. If you know that youth is dying on the run, and my daughter trades dope stories with your son, we need to see what all our fearing and our jeering and our crying and our lying brought about. Take time out.
I wanted to ask you what writing meant to you in terms of bringing together from your past, summoning up, what poetry also meant to you in terms of when you bring that kind of concentration that it takes to write, what happens to the pain or the torment or whatever that you intend to use as that is part of your inspiration, but how do you transform that into your art?
That's quite a question. If you imagine that pain and joy and love and loss are in bowls overflowing, bowls like the Aesop, the bottle in an Aesop tale that never empties, then no matter how much you take out of it, it's still full. But in order to get some release, you take some out of it. After I've written a poem, I feel fine. I feel the tears don't come so readily. I feel released. And until it fills up again, when those bowls fill again, I'm obliged to siphon some of that off, or I'll burst. I don't know if I could live without writing. I work all the time, either on articles or essays or poems or short stories or plays or screenplays or books. It's important for me to know that I'm not out here by myself. So when I read a poem by Gwendolyn Brooks or Dickey or old poetry of Leroy Jones, who I think was the greatest poet in the 60s in the United States, or Nikki Giovanni or John Donne, when I read those, I'm told about the human condition. And so I know that I will make it over. And in turn, I write poetry for the same reason. You know, initially it's for myself, to relieve myself. And secondly, it's so that somebody can say, you know, that's the truth. And so this feeling I have is not so new that it's untenable. I can bear this.
My mother, she's found her sweet glory. My father still living in sin.
You have been listening to poet and writer Maya Angelou reading and singing from her autobiographical works and her poetry. Ms. Angelou was interviewed by Lynn Harris. This program was produced by Lynn Harris with technical assistance by Peter Zanger. Recording engineer, Tom Perotti. Thank you for listening.
Sometimes I don't know where to roam, but I heard of a city called heaven, and I've started to make it more.